Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, welcome to Venus Rising. I'm Callie Fell, the Executive Director at the Center for Bioethics and Culture, and today I'm your host. Today I have the amazing opportunity to sit down and chat with Isabella Malbin. Isabella is the founder of Whose Body Is It? She's a radical birth keeper, a hypnotist, and radical feminist. In 2020, Isabella was peak transed by getting kicked out of a fertility awareness teacher training program for using the words woman and mother. In addition to serving pregnant women in her community, Isabella leads an 8-week educational series for women questioning the ethics of trans ideology, prostitution, pornography, and surrogacy. She also runs a private virtual gender critical community where women connect, conspire, enact change. Hello, Isabella. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
I actually had the pleasure of meeting Isabella in New York City when Jennifer and I were there helping fight against the Child Parent Security Act. And I think you met with us a morning after a long night of helping a mother welcome her newborn into the world. I think you were coming off of being a doula that evening.
Yes, that was, I actually came straight from her labor to meet you because it was a really small sliver of opportunity to meet you. And I didn't want to miss it. And I had been, you know, Instagram messaging Jennifer for a couple months. I was reading a book called Everything Below the Waist by Jennifer Block, another awesome Jennifer. Mm-hmm. And she mentioned Jennifer's films in her book. And then I binged watched all the films and then I found Jennifer on Instagram and I messaged her and then it all, you know, kind of went from there. But yeah, that was a 6-day labor.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I've been following you since then on social media and it seems you're keeping very busy and quite a bit has changed. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how your journey started as someone, as a woman who wanted to empower and serve other women?
Yeah. So I guess my first kind of work with women started with doing childcare and being in people's homes and supporting mothers as they parented children, multiple children. And so I stepped away from that and did a birth and postpartum doula training because I knew that I wanted to have a direct impact and I wanted to serve women. And so I thought that that might be the way how. I thought I would be a postpartum doula and I knew I loved babies, but I was moving away from wanting to work with older children. And so I did a birth and doula training, birth and postpartum doula training, and it changed my life because it opened up this whole world of birth and the injustices that were happening, you know, in obstetric birth. And it also simultaneously was the, you know, a really crucial part of my indoctrination into trans ideology. So during that 4-day in-person training, not only was I learning about, you know, how to be a doula, but I was learning the new speak, the new lexicon that I was to use when serving clients. Mm. And so, yeah, I was basically instructed to not use the words woman and mother and to instead use terms like birthing person, birthing people. And then as I started to teach reproductive health, after being a birth doula for about a year, I got really interested in fertility awareness method and really concerned with what I was learning about the normalcy of women, healthy women taking pharmaceuticals to control their fertility. And so I started teaching reproductive health workshops. And within the training I did for that, I was also instructed to use terms like menstruating, human, uterus haver, things like that. Wow. So it was interesting. It was like I couldn't really peel the two apart you know, I was learning all about women's health and simultaneously unknowingly erasing women while claiming to be for women.
Yeah.
And I'll also say that, you know, I really didn't start to explore the ethics of surrogacy until I joined an online community called the Free Birth Society. And that is a space run by a dear friend of mine named Emily Saldea. And in that space, you know, women were super critical of surrogacy. And so, yeah, surrogacy was always one of those things that I was curious about and fascinated by. And I remember even doing a preliminary internet search and thinking, like, you know, as someone who's fascinated by pregnancy and birth, like, there's a natural curiosity there. And I've spoken to a number of doulas who have had the same experience where they look into what it would take to be a surrogate. Mm-hmm. And I quickly learned that, like, I would not be a candidate because I haven't had children myself. And so I didn't fit the kind of the ideal profile. But yeah, beyond that, you know, I didn't have a stance on surrogacy. And something to note about where I was trained as a doula, which was in New York City, is that the culture in New York City is very pro-surrogacy, very pro-surrogacy. The birth community is very pro-surrogacy because they're very pro-LGBTQ, right? And so you can't, you know, in their eyes, you know, it's all the same. You know, LGBTQ is one unit and you cannot separate them. Like,
right.
And with that, if you say that you support LGBTQ people, then you must also support surrogacy, which is absurd because there are plenty of lesbian women and gay men and bisexual people who absolutely condemn surrogacy and right. third party reproduction. And so yeah, that was kind of the culture that I was practicing in, and those were my colleagues.
That's hard too, and they're the people that you've been, you know, living with, working with, having conversations with, and then all of a sudden you're kind of maybe questioning your own beliefs and your own thoughts, and then who do you turn to kind of talk through those types of difficult conversations and thoughts and beliefs?
Yeah, and you know, I was having a kind of unraveling on multiple fronts. I mean, I was kind of realizing that I was on a different page than a lot of my kind of doula colleagues when it came to birth and really trying to build a practice that centered physiologic birth. And so with that kind of stance, there was a lot of, well, you're shaming women who get epidurals, you're shaming women who choose to have their C-sections and blah, blah, blah. So I was already starting to kind of peel off from that because I started to teach a method called hypnobirthing. And in hypnobirthing, you know, they're very clear about the hierarchy that a physiologic birth is optimal for the well-being of the mother and the child and therefore like our entire society. You know, like the mother and baby is not a vacuum. The mother and baby, like, is society. Everyone is either a mother or a child.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there was, yeah, so I was kind of unraveling that. And then also one of my, like, I've had a lot of, you know, kind of moments that just the cognitive dissonance was so strong. And one of those moments was teaching reproductive health workshops and educating women on the dangers of hormonal birth control. And then also kind of being asked to simultaneously affirm women who believe they're trapped in the wrong bodies to take pharmaceuticals.
Right. Those two, like, don't seem like they can coexist.
Yeah, I don't think they can. And there are plenty of women who are like all about pharmaceuticals for healthy women and also for pharmaceuticals under the guise of like transgenderism. And so there, but yeah, it was in a weird, that was a flag for me where I was like, huh, that's strange that they'd be so critical about hormonal birth control, but then not have anything to say about pharmaceuticals, like Lupron. Like Lupron is fine for a trans identified person, but not for like a woman who's fully embodied. Like what's the difference, you know, what's going on here? So yeah, from there, it was a very rapid, it felt prolonged and rapid at the same time. But, you know, once my eyes started to open about my kind of what, you know, I felt to be complicity in the very system that I was critiquing, specifically obstetric birth, I started to see how I was being complicit in other ways, you know, with trans ideology, and kind of always trying to skirt around and to not hurt people's feelings and to not speak the truth. You know, like I even at one point stopped saying epidural. I just started saying like fentanyl. You know, it's just, we have these euphemisms and they only serve the system. They only serve the pharmaceutical companies. They only serve these kind of pseudo civil rights or like pseudo women's rights campaigns. One of the kind of things that happens is I was in a Facebook group with my doula training program, and I raised concerns about the term belly birth and how I felt that that was normalizing cesarean as like as an option that women should desire, and that, and also just kind of failing to speak to the dangers of cesarean birth. And so there was like a cesarean awareness month, which originally started out as like an educational campaign, but has kind of transformed into like, yeah, yell your cesarean from the rooftops. Like, yes, I had a surgical birth and I'm proud, you know? And yeah, again, it just kind of, for me, came back to like, who is this actually serving? Like, this is not an empowering movement for birthing women. This is a way to normalize another, you know, what should be the most sacred kind of portal and rite of passage of a woman's life, and completely like surrendering that too and giving up that authority. And yeah, so it, you know, in that, of course, I got kicked out of that group. Actually, no, I ended up, they ended up releasing like a statement the next day, kind of scolding me for what had happened. And then I left the Facebook group and subsequently just kind of, you know, never had anything to do with that doula training organization ever again. And so what I was also experiencing on a personal level was really concerning. I just lost all my friends. Like, I was getting emails and messages from colleagues and friends just disgusted by my new kind of critique of birth and pharmaceutical birth control and transgenderism and the erasure of women. And I, you know, I'm extremely critical about Planned Parenthood, but it was really the trans stuff that set people off, that, you know, I think made a lot of women that I know, that I think for them, put them in a position where they're like, I cannot be friends with you because I believe you are a bigot. And if I stay friends with you, that is evidence of my bigotry. You know, that's how I think they maybe rationalized it in their mind. And for me, it was more like, I know that you believe in this movement and I don't. And like, let's talk about it. But there was something knee-jerk that happens with the trans debate that sets people off. And I say that because I felt that I was very much, you know, using language that erases women. You know, I was extremely complicit in that process as like a kind of self-proclaimed liberal feminist. And so I understand that knee jerk. And I also understand hypnosis because I'm a practicing hypnotist, and I really am coming to terms with what I believe to be like a kind of, I don't know how else to say it, but a kind of mind control that has taken place specifically with transgenderism, that just certain words, you know, are so contentious and such trigger words that they have the power to kind of shut people off or to signal that you're not safe to them. And I experienced this a lot. You know, I dated a man who was very critical of transgenderism. And at one point we got into a fight. This is hysterical, but we got into a fight about how we would raise our hypothetical trans child. And I said, I would affirm our hypothetical trans child.
And this is like, before your shift.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. This was almost 3 years ago. And he was like, no, I would absolutely make them wait till they're 18. you know, which is like a moderate stance. He wasn't even saying there is no true trans. He was just saying like, don't trans kids.
Yeah.
And now I feel like, no, I don't believe there is anything like a true trans. I'm not moderate anymore. And, but yeah, so I understand. I remember being really afraid of him in that moment. Like, oh my God, you know, like, I don't know if we can date anymore. Like, this is really, your words are violence. You know, I didn't say that, but I had those thoughts, you know? And so, yeah, it's just funny. But yeah, I totally understand that knee-jerk kind of, that experience. So I, you know, I have to say, like, what I went through on a social level was so shocking that I just thought, well, this thing is really powerful. Mm-hmm. If it can do that to my social life, like if I can lose friendships, 20-year friendships, like women who I considered sisters, then there's something here. And that kind of led me to being this kind of landing pad for women who are questioning the ethics of porn, prostitution, trans ideology, and surrogacy, because they're all related. They're all, you know, woman hating. They're all, you know, yeah, I don't know how to say it. You know, yeah. As Andrea Dworkin would say, they're the center of those like four tenets, or they are woman hating. And so, yeah, I kind of had to piece together my education out of liberal feminism and into radical feminism. And so, yeah, I'm really, you know, I think I've tried to be a landing pad for women who are in that process and unsure and are afraid to even, you know, whisper to their best friend that they're uncomfortable with men coming and demanding access to their women's circles.
So what would you say, or how would you, after walking through this experience, how would you encourage those who are afraid to speak out in their community, either against surrogacy or against transitioning our youth? How would you coach? Because you offer a myriad of resources and offerings on your Whose Body Is It website, and you have coaching and that sort of thing. But how would you encourage people who are, you know, even afraid to whisper against these big ideas?
Well, I would say it depends on who they are, because the consequences are, you know, can be quite severe. And this is not just like celebrities that are being canceled. These are like women with everyday jobs getting fired for being outspoken, you know, for having a gender critical Twitter, for having an Instagram page that critiques the Equality Act. You know, so I would say before speaking out, like I think it's really important to get clear on why it's wrong, like why you believe these things are wrong, because people are going to ask, you know, and I think that like intuition and feeling like in your bones that you know that, you know, having a man in the locker room with your little girl is wrong. Like, I think most women don't need to intellectualize that. You don't need to read a book to know that that's wrong. Like, we feel it in our bones when men are in our spaces, right? We act differently. We move differently for good reason, right? Because we know what men do. And yeah, just get clear on why you believe it's wrong. And, you know, I mean, starting from the basics, like, do you believe that other people have the right to buy women? Right? Do
you believe children, buying children?
Or children.
Right.
Or buying children, exactly. Or do you believe that people can be stuck in the wrong bodies? And like, if so, how does that work? You know, I've really shifted from like being on the defense to asking questions and putting the onus on the person who's like coming at you, you know, depending on who you're talking to. But that is actually, that's one thing that we're doing in the private network that I opened, is that we have templates, actually. We have templates of responses and conversation starters based on who we're speaking to. So
wow.
We have Yeah. Like we have ones for, we just started this. We have ones for talking to trolls, like rude and blunt response when you just know you're talking to a troll. Like you get a DM and you just know it's a troll and you want to respond and you're right before you block. We have conversation starters for like genuinely interested people, personal stories, personal shares for friends and family, like people in your community.
And which and group then, is this that you do this with? Because like you said, you have multiple kind of ways that you're serving different people. So which group would someone be able to find this type of conversation?
So someone who's kind of just getting into this, I would recommend doing the 8-week series, which is a deep dive into the four tenets of liberal feminism that I call kind of the four tenets, which are porn, prostitution, surrogacy, and trans ideology. And then the women who do that 8-week series automatically become members of the virtual private community. And so that is that kind of is comprised of a forum, and we have Zoom calls at least twice a month. And so that is where those templates are kind of housed at the moment.
Gotcha.
But if someone's listening and they're already like, yeah, I know all about trans ideology and surrogacy, and I just want to be in a community with like-minded women, then they can just simply join. It's an annual membership fee, and you join and you get in for a year. And then, for like more high profile women who don't want to be kind of outed or exposed yet, I do one-on-one coaching. And that's also for anyone who just wants, who prefers to kind of work with someone one-on-one. And then I've also been doing these clarity sessions, which are just a kind of one-off session for women to ask questions, get the clarification. Sometimes women just book those sessions to vent, you know, because they have no one else to
You're a friend, or as you say on your Instagram, you know, you're a sister. So it's nice to have someone else to chat with and talk to who's been through this process of what do I believe? Why do I believe it? What happens when people around me don't support what I believe? Or, you know, not even that. I feel so often I get frustrated that we can't have conversations with people who we have different opinions with. We immediately kind of cancel each other out. And I don't know where that started, because I don't remember that being the case when I was smaller. But it seems now it's hard to have conversations with people who believe drastically differently than you do. But I digress.
No, it's very relevant. No, I mean, you know, it's weird because I really grew up in quite like a neoliberal bubble, but I feel like I was always kind of like that. Honestly, I was like a bit of a snob. I don't know how else to put it. You know, like
which you are not the snob. You are the least person I've ever met. You have so much passion and integrity. I love it.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. I grew up believing that like Northerners were just more cultured, smarter, like had more because we had more access to like better things. Like my mom is from the South, and I really held this belief. And also when I was in third grade, George W. Bush was elected president. And that was like so embarrassing because like he had a Southern accent and my mom had a Southern accent. My mom said W and he said W, and like I remember just being humiliated. And so I definitely grew up in a kind of space where just New York and this neoliberal bubble was kind of the center of everything. And it's interesting because it created a lot of tension between me and my mom. And you know what's described, and I know you've probably heard this, but what happens with trans kids is that they are pitted against their parents, and they can very easily report their parents as, with big quotes, transphobic to their teachers and to social services even. And like part of the divisiveness, I think, within trans ideology is the targeting of, you know, the bond between a mother and a child. And I experienced, you know, I mean, I think a lot of children go through that kind of tension in adolescence with their parents for sure. But there was something distinct in my experience with my mom where I felt like she was somehow kind of like behind the times. And, you know, because she didn't affirm everything that I was saying all the time about, you know, when I was talking about trans ideology and how I thought it was like all that jazz, you know, she wasn't, you know, affirming what I was saying all the time. And I remember, yeah, just getting really angry and just thinking how regressive she was. And yeah, I think that's, and, you know, now that I've kind of come around to see the harms, you know, my mom would talk about female oppression and I'd be like, I just wasn't interested. It was so strange. And now that I've kind of like come full circle, it's actually opened up a dialogue and brought us closer in kind of that department and that space. But yeah, it's heartbreaking to just think about like kind of the extreme version of that. It's just, you know, would have been for me to say, no, I'm trans, you know, and if you don't do this for me, I'll never speak to you again. If you don't do this, I'm going to tell the teachers at school that you're transphobic. Like, I remember pushing boundaries and, you know, trying to get my mom to do things, you know, like we have a later curfew and I wanted like lots of piercings and tattoos. And she was like, no, you know, and she really like was firm about that. And the other example I bring up is, you know, she was really cautious about who I spent the night with, like a friend with an older brother, for example. Like, she was really cautious about that because she knows what, you know, boys do. And like that kind of boundary setting and was, I think, really important. But it also, it's easy to say like, oh, parents should just have harder boundaries. But it's like, these parents are up against like the craziest shit, like these influencers on YouTube sending their children binders for free if the parents refuse to buy them for them. I mean, yeah. It's like that. And then the kind of just confused parents who have a kid who says they're gender dysphoric or whatever, or says they're trans, and then they go on the internet and they look up gender therapist and they take them to the therapist, and the therapist is like, your kid is trans. You know, it's like, what if everyone is saying to this parent, the teachers, the therapists, the community, that their kid is trans, and if the sooner they accept it, the happier they'll be. I mean, that is like the ultimate gaslighting. It's like that mother grew that child and birthed that child. Like, she knows more than anyone what the sex of the child is. I mean, it's so, yeah, as you know, it's crazy.
So do you, and you kind of hit on this, do you think, so we're kind of talking about the transitioning of children and surrogacy and fertility, and it seems that there are large profitable markets for these types of things, right? We talk about it in our film, Big Fertility, kind of like how people kind of oppose like big pharma, right? And do you think that's happening here? Like, you know, fertility companies and, you know, pharmaceuticals for the transition medications and drugs.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is all of it. I mean, Jennifer Bilek. Oh, who was that? Yeah, who we at that, at our morning, or when we met, Jennifer Bilek, who's there. She does a lot of writing that follows the money. She's a fantastic journalist, and she wrote a piece that quoted Market Watch. So Market Watch's projection is that by 2026, the sex reassignment industry will reach a profit of $1.5 billion.
That's ridiculous.
And that's just the sex reassignment, which, by the way, is just a marketing ploy. As I'm sure hopefully your listeners know, like, there is no such thing as sex reassignment. Like, right. Sex biology is immutable. Mm-hmm. So even though I hate, I have to use the word transition when I'm talking about this stuff, but even the word transition is, again, it's part, it reinforces the ideology. These words reinforce this ideology that, like, I don't believe in. And so, yeah, so Jennifer Bilek has a piece where she goes into the kind of projected profits, and she makes the distinction that $1.5 billion doesn't even include all the other stuff. Like that's just the surgeries. Like that doesn't include all the hormones, all the trans books, all the trans clothing lines, the trans modeling agencies, the trans acting agencies, the trans educational material. Like it that doesn't even include that. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen like a kind of niche be, I wouldn't call it a niche anymore. It's completely dominated the birth world, the mainstream birth world, you know, and midwifery schools too. Women write to me who are studying to be midwives, licensed midwives, and tell me they can't believe what they're asked to do in their trainings. And nurses, and I'm wondering actually if you experienced this in your training. I get messages like that quite a lot. But yeah, the profit, the pharmaceuticals, it's and the whole trans kid thing, like the whole trans thing needs children in order to make it seem legitimate, right? Because if we're saying that there are trans adults, well, right, the whole purpose of it is to convince people that this is a human condition versus a societal condition, like a reaction to sexism.
Yeah, in my, I would say, you know, I'm a labor and delivery nurse, and I wouldn't say that it's so much infiltrated our training, but I have had some interesting stories. I had a couple a while back that I was starting to take care of them, and I walked into the room very excited for them. It's an exciting time for most families, and I asked if they knew if they were having a boy or girl. And I was met with such disdain that I would ask that, and that, you know, this child would decide for itself later. And, you know, and it just, I kind of was floored because, you, like you said, it's biology at first, you know, it's, are you having a, and of course there are certain situations where the biology and the genetics have, there are conditions where that's not the case, but that those are rare as far as like if you have, some babies are born with internal female parts, but external genitalia. But yeah, I was just kind of flabbergasted that was the kind of how I was met in that situation. So I definitely have seen it.
Yeah, it's shocking. And this is, I think so many, I think every single person on the planet, I'm just going to go ahead and say it, like would benefit from like a radical feminist 101 course, like just the different or like beyond biology, because it's not just biology. Right? We're talking about the difference between gender and sex, mm-hmm. and like what is innate and what is a stereotype. And so like their reaction, I think what they're hearing when you ask that is like, is your kid going to wear pink or blue? Are they going to be like a plumber or a ballerina? You know, like, which is not what you're saying. You're literally just asking what the sex is, which is a fact.
Correct. Yes.
Like there's no story, like the story that they have about you asking that is that you must be
stereotyping their child before birth.
Yeah. It's so, I don't know if you saw the cover of, I think it was Vogue, Emma Rada, I think her name, she's a supermodel. She's pregnant. And she was on the cover of a fashion magazine. And the headline was like, why I'm not going to learn the gender of the baby.
And it's like, I didn't see that, no.
The number of times I see just the terms conflated is infuriating. It's infuriating to have a women's magazine conflate the terms and be complicit in the erasure of women. It's mind-boggling.
Can you explain for people that are listening that maybe not, you know, this is a new topic for them, how does the trans ideology erase women, right? Like why is that a danger to women?
So trans ideology erases women and men. But because we live under patriarchy, men will always rise to the top. So there really isn't male, you know, I mean, one might argue that there is male erasure happening too, but like one example of this in how men always rise to the top while women fade bottom background is that there are a number of trans identified people in power now in the US. They're all men. They're all men who identify as women. They're not women who identify as men, and they're not women.
Right. Okay.
Right. They're men who identify as women. So female erasure really speaks to the kind of downfall and the regression of women's sex-based protections. So not just on a social level, right? Not just the fact that we have to pretend that woman is a thing, right? Which is disturbing and violates like all personal freedom and religious belief. Like for me to ask me to pretend a man coming to my circle is a woman just like me, with a couple quirks, like, is absurd. So that, to ask me to say that woman is not immutable, woman is not innate, inherent, like to imply that woman, not to imply, but to say that actually being a woman is a choice, that is extremely damaging, because we know that as women, we cannot opt out. Even when we cut off our breasts and we have hysterectomies, we are still targeted because we are women, right? Because we are of the, we are a part of the same sex class that has an oppressor sex class, which is the male sex class. And so women know this, and even women who call themselves men know this, so much so that they, you know, one thing that comes up with trans men, which nobody cares about because they're women, is that a lot of them won't change their legal sex in the case that they were to be arrested. Because if their legal sex said that they were men, they'd be put in a men's prison. Mm-hmm. And that is just flat out dangerous. Like, men's prisons are already dangerous for other men, let alone putting a woman in there who has a beard, right? They're going to find out she doesn't have a dick in 5 seconds.
Right.
And so there's erasure in a kind of social sense, like asking us to kind of pretend that it's this sex is this thing that we can opt in and out of. And there's, you know, just a kind of just a mass neutering that's happening, that's been happening with pharmaceutical birth control that puts our health in serious jeopardy. And so, yeah, these young women are getting neutered, and it's really scary. It's really sad. And it, you know, it's also really related to homophobia as well, right? That a lot of these young women hate being a woman so much, perhaps because they like to have sex with other women, and that's not okay in their community. Right. That homophobia is still an issue even in 2020. And I spoke to a detransitioned woman recently named Lee, who speaks to this, that, you know, her in-laws, her wife's in-laws only approved of her when she became a man. Right. They couldn't, because in their mind it was like, oh, it's a medical condition that needs to be fixed. And she's fixed now, versus just accepting the fact that their daughter was a lesbian,
right?
You know,
who enjoyed other women. Yeah.
So yeah, with other female erasure stuff, just what's happening in the law is kind of the biggest concern, just on a legislative capacity, which is the Equality Act that Biden wants to pass, which basically includes gender identity. It replaces sex with gender identity, meaning that women lose the right to have separate private spaces away from men. That any man can self-ID as a woman, and that his choice to do that, he is protected in the law. So it's all under the guise of equality. But what it does is it erases what women had fought for, right? We're in a complete regression now, which is the right to separate sex segregated spaces. And so, yeah, so we see this in sports as well. So.
Right. I found it interesting too, just kind of to that point that it seems like we're a little bit regressing. This year was it the 100th year for women to be able to vote? And I didn't see that being celebrated anywhere. You know, it kind of got caught up in everything else that's going on in 2020. But I found that very fascinating that wasn't a celebrated thing this year. And what a huge monumental, you know, step for us and for women. So we were talking about the classes that you offer and the coaching, and I saw that you offer what's called birth processing. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit more just about like what that included. And is this more like women who come to you after their own birth, whether it be immediately or several years later, or is this more for birth workers who maybe have left an experience feeling as if they didn't provide adequate or great care? And then, you know, after answering that, what does it look like for you? Tell us about the class. And then I'm also interested, have you had any surrogate mothers come to you for birth processing to kind of talk about their experiences and the loss of a child after they went home?
Oh, that's a great question. So the birth processing, so I offer a birth processing session for both mothers and birth workers. And so for the mothers, it's generally a space to process trauma. So feeling feelings like they weren't heard, like their wishes weren't met. Some of them are just kind of overt kind of like rape and violation stories. And also trauma can happen at home, right? This isn't exclusive to being outside the home. But so yeah, that's a space where they're coming to me because they know that I'm not going to reframe what they're sharing, which happens regularly with just kind of normalizing women suffering. Like we all do it. I do it. We all are participants in, my friend Dipity says, we are all in cahoots with the patriarchy. And so these are women who are coming specifically to me because they know that I'm not going to reframe their abuse and say, oh, well, at least you had a healthy baby. And then I also work with a set of tools which helps to, shift. It gives women the opportunity to shift out of the kind of victim consciousness around what happened to them. It's tricky because women are absolutely victims of oppression, and we have the ability to like gain awareness and consciousness and to shift out of that and to make a different choice, for the next birth or the next whatever it is. So after the initial session of just them sharing their story, we shift into this framework of taking responsibility and shifting in a way that the next time they have a baby, they won't be walking into the exact situation. Because I saw that a lot as a birth worker. I'd support a mom who, was really traumatized by her birth with an OB, but then would go back to the same place just with in the birthing center with a midwife.
Gotcha.
Right? Like thinking she was going to get something different, but then just getting a different flavor of the same kind of experience that she didn't want. And so yeah, like so that's a little bit of that. And then for birth workers, I experienced a lot of, I don't really call it secondary trauma anymore. I feel like I was complicit in things that I was critiquing, and I was not in my integrity serving women in the very space that I was so critical of, and then also taking money from them to do that. These were women coming to me specifically to avoid interventions. And then, even if they were able to avoid kind of the things like the epidural, the Pitocin, a C-section, those women were still kind of manhandled and their babies were manhandled and things happened to them and were done to them that they didn't want to happen. And so also when I realized that, I was like, oh, wow, I'm holding a lot here. And there are other women, there are other doulas who are holding this too. And the guilt, and the shame. And yeah, some of those stories I'll never forget of women just kind of looking at me in horror, like wondering like how they got here and why I was there and why didn't I tell them that this was going to happen too. That came up a lot. And so, yeah, so I have those sessions for birth workers, specifically also birth workers who are wanting to shift and support women outside of hospitals and birthing centers. And so, yeah, I also hold village prenatals in my community right now. That's kind of the center of my birth work at this point, is holding those in-person community gatherings. And so then with serving, no, I've never served a surrogate mother. I've never been asked to, and I would not ever. I definitely wouldn't be the doula for her.
Wow. Well, that's been a really great time talking to you. We're getting close to wrapping up for our time. Is there anything else that you would like to add or enlighten our listeners with before we say our goodbyes?
I would say anyone who's curious to learn more and who like wants a bit of hand holding through kind of untangling all of this, that there are women out there like myself, like you, like Jennifer Law, who have the resources and have the education to be able to share and kind of walk with you in that. It can seem really lonely. Part of the divisiveness of having unpopular thoughts is that you feel, most women feel very alone. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would just say that there are a lot of us kind of on the other side. We're ready to receive you and hold you as you kind of come into what you already know to be true, which is that this, you know, whether it's surrogacy or trans ideology, it is not for women.
And we'll include in the introduction or the written portion of the podcast, we'll include your website and some materials for our listeners so that they can dig in and hopefully contact you as appropriate. So, but thank you again so much for sitting down with me. It's been great. I get to see you because I'm watching you via Zoom, but it's been great to see you and chat with you again. And hopefully once COVID dissipates and we get beyond this, we'll be able to actually see each other and have coffee once again. So thanks a lot, Isabella.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.